Welcome to the Zeke Sky Podcast.
Hey guys, thank you so much for joining me today on the Zeke Sky Podcast. I think a lot of us have been following the events that have unfolded in the United States with a fair amount of historical awe. A sense that something unprecedented has been going on for a while. But I really think that while we're in very well adapted to understand those just light bulb moments, those lightning rod moments like 9/11, we're a little less able to understand historical trends that do the sorts of things that might appear in the bold texts of the social studies books in 100 years. And they'll appear that way because future historians will notice patterns that the public at large probably would have a more hard time noticing. You know, it's one thing to observe the catastrophic effects of something like the trade centers coming down. That's something that everyone can wrap their mind around. But the end of U.S. global hegemony, which is a topic for which there is considerable conversation right now, is not something that is as easily observable, and it requires a set of priors and facts about history to understand fully. And I think questions of national identity are being invoked here that I think are so fundamental that a lot of the people, especially people who are getting into their 60s and 70s now and who have not known a world in which the U.S. was not the champion of the world, it's involving questions that are uncomfortable for everyone to ask, especially around that age. One of the questions is, how did we become this thing? And I think part of the reason we became this thing was it was in some ways a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I also think there's an angle of it where you can see very quickly that the United States was a reluctant global hegemon and that this wasn't specifically the intent of really anyone. We should look at the quotes of some of our leaders to understand some of this better, to know where this sense of identity might have come from. President Jefferson referred to the young nation he helped found as the world's best hope. That's one of the most important Jefferson quotes. It's strange to me thinking about why he might have thought that. He must have thought that there was a certain singularity of the United States Revolution that made it so different from other revolutions, and I think that that's true, but it would have been hard to know something like that at the time. And at the moment that that's happening, John Adams, who was one of his great rivals, is sending off, you know, a force of people to go throw off a set of leaders in Haiti that were determined to be not democratic enough, or so the story goes. And there's still mentions of it over the coming 150 years between the two quotes I'm about to mention, but it seems like this whole thing gets more pronounced after World War II. It seems like after there is this conspicuous victory in World War II, we get more verbose descriptions and more identity qualities, maybe you could say, of what it is that the United States should be. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower said, here's a quote from Dwight Eisenhower. He said, "We could be the wealthiest and the most mighty nation and still lose the battle of the world if we do not help our world neighbors protect their freedom and advance their social and economic progress." That seems like something that was used over and over again as the pretext for a lot of things that have happened in the last 30 or 40 years that, with a little bit of retrospect, maybe could have been taken with some caution. Kennedy got more verbose about it. Kennedy came after Eisenhower, and here's the quote from Kennedy I found. He said, quote, "We will pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, in order to assure the survival and success of liberty." And you get more of it as the years go by. I mean, you get Ronald Reagan calling the United States the shining city on a hill, and Barack Obama even reprised that quote despite the differences between those two. And one of the big points I want to make today is that I think that this is part of a constructed identity that exists in America now. And when I say that it's a constructed identity, I mean it is not an inherent identity. It is not an inherent feature. Whereas we in the United States, we don't have a shared origin story or a shared racial story. We're all types of people mixed up, and we pride ourselves on that. Whereas other nations have a long history, and it is concrete stuff, which they can actually use in foreign policy today. I mean, you can connect so much of what happened in Germany over the last, really, let's talk about maybe thousands of years, to a sense of militarism and expansionism and aggression against foes. In the United States, the core parts of our identity are really, they're intangibles. They're the ideas that come from stuff like the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. That is our shared identity right there. And not to say that that is a weak identity, but you actually need more. You need a story, not just about what you're entitled to do in a place and where you come from, but where are you going and what is your role in the world? And I think historians are very well aware of this. They're really aware of what you might call the teleology of what goes on in the United States, the goal-based nature of its existence. Because when you can ascertain the goals of a person or, you know, a nation, you can figure out so much of the stuff that comes after that. And you can figure out maybe where things might be going. And one of the things that's becoming clear right now, one of the reasons I made this podcast, is we're now entering, I think, into a different world entirely than the one that I think started around 1949 and 1950. In the aftermath of World War II, the United States, which was previously, let's be clear, an isolationist nation, reluctantly, that's important to say, reluctantly sort of took on this role as a global leader. And this led to unprecedented economic growth, scientific advancements, human flourishing, and ultimately a lot of peace. You don't want to say that the world has been that peaceful over the last 60, 70 years, but looking at the evidence of the things that came before that time and what an actual baseline is, yes, it has been relatively more peaceful to be on Earth in the last 70 years. And it was not just our wealth that contributed to our ability to do this. There was buy-in all over the world. There were people all over the world that thought the United States was a unique force for good. And there is certainly a lot of evidence to this fact and to it being true. There's philosophical precedence for this too. There was a guy called Immanuel Kant, who was a very important philosopher, who had this idea about perpetual peace. This was something he was obsessed with. He thought that the more democracies you had on Earth, the better off everyone was, and the less likely global wars and catastrophes were. And I think if you take that at its face value, the conclusion is that democracy should be spread everywhere, no matter what the cost. But what if the cost is tens of millions of lives? These are the types of questions that you would ask yourself, not only if you believed democracy was the way forward for human civilization, but what if you thought communism was? I mean, Vladimir Lenin and Joseph Stalin had this exact idea in the other direction, and they killed tens of millions of their own people for the sake of implementing it. And it was a great evil for them to do that. But at the same time, the core of these two ideas, perpetual peace thesis, starts to have quite a bit of overlap with the communist project at a certain point, because if you've decided that any price is worth paying, you have problems. But if your core philosophy is communism and you're killing people all over that, it relies on a future result that is 100% unproven. If your vision of peace comes from democracy, you have a lot of history and a lot of current events that prove out that the point was right. And so here's the only thing I want to point out here. Fundamental to the United States identity that we've established and its crystallization in recent history is the idea that democracies are superior over dictatorships. Simple. And the importance of upholding territorial integrity is also important, that sovereign nations are sovereign and they have the right to conduct their elections in the way they want to do them. And right now, given what has gone on with the Trump administration and with Ukraine, the rest of the world is looking around and reevaluating whether the United States still has the identity qualities that made it the thing that it has been for so long. So many people talk about this issue like it's a question of how much money we give away. Guys, this is not the point here. We could cut off all of that money. That could be not a thing we did anymore. If we were at least performatively against dictatorships and stood up for democracies, that would be still a great situation. That would be good enough in many ways. And yet we have a president of the United States who is taking to Twitter to demonize the plight of a sovereign democratic nation that was attacked in cold blood. Thank you for joining me today on the podcast.